Welcome to the Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church.
Well, welcome to Keys of the Kingdom. I'm Brother Gregory, and again, we're going to be talking about the Kingdom of God, and we've kind of started a series as an offshoot of Leviticus, when we're going through Leviticus one chapter at a time. Got up into the area of what they were calling leprosy, and many scholars don't believe that they were actually talking about what we know as leprosy today, and that they were talking about something else, and different both Jewish and Christian scholars were thinking that this was actually, they were using the idea of disease as a sort of metaphor, and there were a lot of other metaphors in that conversation, and we'll return to that, and we'll show you some of the other appear as you look at the Hebrew language, because it was written in Hebrew, and there's all kinds of messages in it. And so the important thing to understand that the Bible was actually talking about what people needed to know after coming out of the bondage of Egypt. And of course, it was talking about how you went into the bondage of Egypt, how you went into the bondage of Babylon, and why Abraham was coming away from Ur and coming away from Haran and his own family, because his father was, in quotes, an idolater. And what is idolatry? Well, it's very clear, according to Paul, that covetousness is idolatry, and idolatry is covetousness. And so therefore, what in the ideology or beliefs or the thinking or practices of Terah, the father of Abraham, was making him an idolater? Was it the building of statues, or was it some sort of covetous practice? And of course, if you go back to our studies on Leviticus, which you can find at preparingyou.com, just look up Leviticus as a part of the Bible, and you will see that there is, you know, that we've been going through the different chapters in the New Testament, the Old Testament, some of the minor prophets. And it's quite a challenge to go through all these different ideas and parts of the Bible, because as we are uncovering the true meaning of what Abraham was doing, the true meaning of what Moses was teaching the people in Leviticus and Deuteronomy. I mean, we pointed out in Deuteronomy 17 that they actually are telling you the elements of a constitution if you decide to have a ruler who can exercise authority one over the other. There's really no point in reading the Bible, reading Leviticus, understanding what was going on back there in those days if it doesn't apply to us today. And of course, there's a certain eschatology that's out there that the Old Testament, all that was done away with. The truth is, the Old Testament is one of two witnesses, because Moses and Jesus Christ were in agreement a lot more than most modern eschatologies realize, because they don't really understand what was going on in the Old Testament. And it's very important that we do grasp these ideas and bring them up to date, because man's the same, God's the same, so likely we're making the same mistakes, or at least have the potentiality of making the same mistakes today. So we want to relate our studies to what is actually going on today. So when we look at Leviticus, we're trying to bring Leviticus up to speed with what's going on today. And one of the ways we did this was with the interim story of the Silitan martyrs. And you can find out about them. I have the actual records of at least the second trial of the martyrs. There were 12 altogether. There were six in this second trial. The first six had already been convicted, and they knew that. And so when they were brought before this Saturninus, this governor of that district, who was going to try them for tax evasion, literally that's what they were going to be tried for, is tax evasion. And the question is, were they really guilty, or was he overstepping his authority as judge? And that's a really quick rundown. We have to kind of approach what was going on, because Christ was a revolutionary, but he wasn't teaching rebellion. He was teaching the way. Moses didn't preach rebellion. He didn't get the people to rise up and start disobeying the Pharaoh to bring them up out of Egypt. The same as Jesus says, give to Caesar what is Caesar's. But he arranged the events of their time so that they were literally cast out of the system that brought them into bondage. It is very important that we understand what Jesus was doing, what Moses was doing, what the Israelites had to learn to do in order to be Israel. And you're not Israel if you're not doing what Moses and Jesus Christ agreed upon. So we take these little side trips to show you in this court of law in the Roman Empire what was going on in this trial, what they were really being charged with, and did they have the right to do that? So we already have several audios, and then of course we already have supporting audios and articles to set the scene. You know, we have we did a review of the Christian checklist, what it meant to be Christian. Jesus said there would be many claiming to be Christian, but he doesn't even know them, and they don't seem to know him. They're actually so far away from what he was actually saying. He calls them workers of iniquity and tells them to get away. And that's part of that division that Christ comes to bring a sword. He's going to divide the true Christian from the false Christian, just as he was dividing the true Israelite or true Jew. We can use that word Jew, because technically speaking, Peter and eventually Paul, Paul would have been called a Jew at the time of Jesus Christ. He wasn't persecuting Christ yet, but shortly after the resurrection, Paul was persecuting Christians. And then he converted. Peter was for Orthodox Judaism. And then he saw that, well, wait a minute, some of what we think of as Orthodox Judaism is false. It's not really what Moses was saying. And of course, Jesus had said the same thing, that you don't even know Moses. You claim to be following Moses, but you don't, because they had misinterpreted things, books like Leviticus, books like Deuteronomy. And they had one of the key elements that they were getting wrong was that they had established a system of Corban. Corban is just the Hebrew word for sacrifice. It actually means free will sacrifice. And they had changed that. If you signed up with Herod's civil system of social welfare, you would have to pay in. You didn't have to sign up, but once you signed up, you had to pay in. Because, you know, God is a God of contract. God is a God of covenants. So if you made a covenant with Herod and the Pharisees, that sounded real good, that we're going to take care of the needy of society. That's what religion was. was how you took care of the needy of society. And of course, Abraham was taking care of the needy of society. Jacob was taking care of the needy of society. And for part of Jacob's life, he did it like Laban. Laban did it like Terah and Nahor. But Abraham did it a different way. Edom, the Edomites, they began to take care of the needy of society different than what Abraham was doing. He got along with Jacob when Jacob came back. At one time, he wanted to kill Jacob. But then Jacob came bestowing all kinds of blessings on Esau. And they got along. But Jacob didn't want to travel with Esau. He didn't want to keep company with Esau. He wanted Esau, you go do your thing. I'm going to go do my thing. And over the years that followed, what Jacob was doing changed more like Abraham. And so to see those changes, we've had to go back and look at the Hebrew. Did Jacob really build tents for his livestock? Was he putting these probably almost wild-like cows and sheep in tents? Because it says he built sukkos for his livestock. Except it is my contention that the word livestock there meant his possessions. But of course, because he had been doing things like Laban, the people that followed him were his possessions. They were human resources. And we know that the king of Sodom, Bera, turn the people into human resources. He told Abraham, you can keep the stuff, just give me the people. Because he thought of the people as human resources, possessions. And there are some people that like being possessions. They like the security of the welfare state, which is how you become a possession, which of course Peter tells us. That if you desire benefits from men who call themselves benefactors, men in government who call themselves benefactors, but exercise authority one over the other, which is by definition a covetous practice, that you will be made merchandise. And you will curse your children with that same idea. Now, those of you who listen regularly, you can go and you know, we've already got articles, you know, like merchandise, cursed children. These are all quotes right out of the Bible. And we show you, why did Peter say that? Why is he saying that covetous practices make you merchandise? Well, the same reason that Paul tells you that covetousness is idolatry. Idolatry makes you merchandise. It makes you a possession of the state. Property of the state, human resources. Now, to some who never listen, have never listened to us, this may all seem a little foreign. So we go back and we look at things like Leviticus and Deuteronomy, and we show you what was actually going on with Melchizedek, with Abimelech, and why they call Abimelech, Abimelech, Father King, and Melchizedek, Righteous King, because Melchizedek is receiving tithings. Abimelech is receiving taxes. He's shearing his flocks. He's shearing the people. He's extracting what they owe. And he has a right to do that. Because usually somewhere along the line, the people agree to it. Now, there's all kinds of scenarios how you would end up under such authority. I mean, you could be out to sea and pirates attack your ship and steal all the stuff in your ship and steal your ship or maybe even sink your ship and they sell you into slavery. Or maybe they say, you can join our crew. And if you don't want to join the crew, you can walk the plank. In other words, leave the ship. which isn't so bad if you're at shore, but if you're out at sea, it's a bad deal. Unless you can swim a long, long way. That's coercion. And if in the book Covenants of the Gods, we actually quote ancient maxims of law that talk about you can't really be made a slave by a pirate, because once you're out of the grip of the pirate, you're free again, because they can't coerce you into becoming a pirate. You might cooperate a little bit just so you don't have to walk the plank, but that's coercion. But when you do it to obtain benefits, the dainties of rulers, then you create a binding situation. And of course, that's how they got in the bondage of Egypt. They went to Egypt and Egypt gave them free bread. That's what destroyed Rome, free bread. Free bread and circuses destroyed Rome. It broke down the moral character of the people. And so whatever system that was being created by Jesus, John the Baptist, Moses, the prophets, it was bringing you in the direction, in the way of liberty, the perfect law of liberty. But you need to understand what that is so that you don't step over. And a number of people have sent me things just this morning, and we're going to take a quick look at that. And then see what, you know, why they did that. Why they are saying some of the things that they did. And one of the things was on the economy. And they talk about what Trump was doing and maybe dangerously going to collapse the economy because of the war and all these kinds of things. And people had little films that's really popular now where they'll play a little reel, and they present certain facts of law. And many of them are correct about law or history or current events, but they also leave out certain parts. And it's what they leave out that will actually lead to so that you get the bigger picture, because what they do is they want to narrow your focus. And of course, we've seen the media doing that, you know, hate Trump, hate the leaders and everything. We can find a dozen quotes in the Bible that tell you don't hate the leaders. Don't hate Pharaoh. Don't hate Caesar. Actually, give to Caesar what you owe Caesar. I don't know what you owe Caesar, but there's actually ways in which you can fall under the authority, you know, become that human resource. And that's why I wrote the book Covenants of God, shows you 15 different ways you can go under the authority of whatever government you're in, whatever country you live in. And so you want to don't go those ways. You want to go the way of Christ. And people tell you, you know, a lot of things about the way of Christ, but they also leave out very important things in the way of Christ that modern Christians aren't doing, which of course is why, you know, on our page at the Celotin Martyrs, we took a section where you can go check the Christian checklist, because the checklist is going to show what Christians were doing this and they wouldn't do that. They would die rather than do some of the things many modern Christians do readily. And these were martyrs just less than 100 years after Jesus Christ and many of the apostles. They knew men who knew the apostles. And so they had a pretty good perspective on Christianity. There was confusion seeping in. But today, we're a long ways away from Christian, just like the Pharisees were a long ways away from Moses. So much so that though they thought they were following Moses, and there are many Pharisees today that think they're following Moses and are actually far from him. But there are many Christians who think they're following Christ and they're actually far from him too. And what we want to do is share with them the information in the Spirit of Christ so that they will see what they're missing. Now, whether they'll see it or not, that's going to be up to them. It's going to be up to you, what you want to see and what you don't want to see. And often when you start showing people these things, it can become extremely uncomfortable. And so those are some of the things we're going to look at about the economy. We're going to touch on the war, but we're going to get back to the Silliton martyrs and what was the legitimate or illegitimate essentials of the charges brought against those Christians. And understanding that may help us understand what Christians, what they should be doing today. And so a couple of the other things that we're going to look at, that some of the quotes, you know, we're going to look at John Adams, Edmund Burke, and somebody named Craig who was on Facebook who posted something. And we're going to go through those as quickly as we can and get back to the Silliton martyrs. We'll be right back. So welcome back to Keys of the Kingdom. So one of the first things that somebody was writing was that talking about the fear of this economic collapse that is maybe going to come because of the activities of the Iranian war and the expenditures of it. The reality is, if you read our article on the Cloward and Piven strategy, it has been a plan of the progressives for a long time to bankrupt the nation through systems of social welfare. Americans didn't sign up fast enough, so eventually they got the idea of bringing in people from other countries to sign up for social welfare. And they actually, under LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson, when he realized that he was going to have to sign the Civil Rights Act, he thought, well, I'm going to win the Democrat, the black vote into the Democratic Party by offering them all kinds of benefits and making them dependent upon those benefits. And you actually, if you go back and look at how many, because most blacks were Republicans. The first blacks in public office were all Republicans. They weren't Democrats. Democrats was the party of the KKK. But blacks moved as a general population from the Republican Party to the Democratic Party because literally the government agencies, the vast bureaucracy, as William O. Douglas called them, which he refers to them as the new George III, they began to target the black community to get the black community signed up for social welfare. Now they've gone into the white community, the Asian community, and more they want, and you see even the Republican Party is moving. It was just in the news before this program began, is that even the Republican Party is moving more and more towards socialism. And how far they're moving towards it would require that you have some sort of base marker. You know, it's like the lazy worker. I heard a fella, I asked a guy, is he a very good worker? And he says, well, you got to pound a stake in the ground to see if he's moving. And in other words, you have to have some sort of standard by which to measure how close to socialism you're getting, because the mere idea of public education through tax dollars is socialism. That's in the Communist Manifesto. A national bank that issues, that creates money. What they actually do is create debt notes, and they call it money, but it's not really a value. Federal Reserve notes have no value. Even the Federal Reserve admits that. They're notes. They're promises to pay. And then, of course, they can change the terms about that. So, but that's a communist idea. And you actually even find it in ancient Rome. At the time of Jesus Christ. Nero, well, Mark Antony and Cleopatra took 10% of the silver out of the silver denarii that Mark Antony and Cleopatra produced. And Nero took even more out, almost half of the silver. And by Diocletian, there was no more silver left in the Roman silver denarii. It wasn't silver anymore. And of course, inflation pursued, because if your money doesn't have any intrinsic value, there will be inflation. And inflation is just the invisible tax of Nimrod. And of course, we saw the same thing in Egypt, that they had to have some sort of commodity money that wasn't a commodity, that was, you know, clay scarabs. And they did that. And all the gold was in the treasury of the Pharaoh. But of course, that in itself is idolatry. And which is why, if you go read our article on the golden calf was a central bank, a reserve fund made up of the gold of the people that was consolidated into this statue like a vault. All the Greek city-states, not all of them, many of the Greek city-states had golden statues, which were referred in the Greek to as a reserve fund. So if you don't know that about history, you don't understand where your nation started moving towards socialism, towards communism, towards Babylon. Because Babylon was a one-purse system. Socialism is a one-purse system. They talk in the Bible in more than one place about flesh pots and cauldrons. And they even tell you that, let's build us a city, a civil government. And that civil government will be our cauldron. And we will be the flesh in that cauldron. We will become the human resources in that civil cauldron. Now, these are all, it's metaphors, but they say they're building a city and they're describing it with these metaphors. And if you understand how the Hebrew language works, this all starts to fall into place. You're not going to get that part of the sermon in most of your modern Christian churches. They're going to tell you to come to church, tie it to me, and then if you need anything, if you need your parents taken care of, you need health care, you have widows that need assistance, you go to the government. And the government is full of men who exercise authority one over the other, and they are your benefactor. Meanwhile, we'll sit on golden thrones, we'll wear golden hats, we'll have gigantic bank accounts, billions and billions of dollars in assets. But if you need something, now we'll do some charity. It's good for the press, you know, good for our image. But 90% of all your welfare is going to come from men who exercise authority one over the other. And of course, that's completely the opposite of what Christ was saying and teaching. And yet, and he was pretty clear about it. You know, I mean, Matthew 20:25, but Jesus called them unto him, the apostles, and said, ye know the princes of the Gentiles exercise dominion over them, and they that are great exercise authority upon them, but it shall not be so amongst you. He says the same thing in Mark 10:42. He says the same thing in Luke 22:25. Slightly worded different, but it's clearly, it's the same speech in all these different gospels, right out of the mouth of Jesus to the apostles who are going to become the church, his holy separate church, right out of the box at the beginning. He says, and he said unto them, the kings of the Gentiles, the rulers of the Gentiles, the basileus of the Gentiles in the Greek, exercised lordship over them. They have authority. They're they have a chief executive officer. Maybe we call him a president or a prime minister, but he's the guy that exercises authority upon them. And they're called benefactors because they give you benefits. Where do they get the money to give you benefits? They take it away from your neighbor. They borrowed against the future of your children. And Jesus says it's not to be that way with you. So no Christian, no follower of Christ should desire benefits from men who exercise authority by taking away from their neighbor. That's the leaven of Herod and the Pharisees and the Sadducees. The oppression, because leaven has to do with oppression. And if you go back to our studies in Exodus, and we have an article on leaven, we show you that's the complaint. It isn't about the yeast they're using. It's about the system they're using to take care of the needy of society. Moses said, well, no, we're not going to do it that way. Jesus said, beware of the leaven of Herod and the Pharisees, the oppression in their system of Corban, of sacrifice, because it will make the word of God to none effect. So grasping these simple ideas, because, you know, if you're desiring benefits at the expense of your neighbor, that's pretty much coveting your neighbor's goods. You want to take, and that's public education originally was often done through the church. It'd be a minister who would set it up, who funded it, the free will offerings of the people. It wasn't funded by public monies. Although we've gone through the history of that, where some, even Thomas Jefferson, was suggesting that some sort of public money would be provided. The financing of it is not very clear, but they were doing some of that because all the churches in America were not following the ways of Christ just because they were in America. The Anglican Church was supported by tax dollars. Tax on tobacco was funding the salaries of Anglican ministers. And early America, people like Patrick Henry, in our study on some of the things that he was saying, he opposed the Constitution, by the way. He wasn't the only one, many did, because he feared when bad men take office, bad things are going to happen. So, what about the economy and what Trump's doing? The fact is, if you remember, if you got that stake in the ground, history, facts, information, we were rapidly moving towards economic collapse. Inflation way out of hand. Price of oil was going up, price of eggs was going up, price of a lot of things were going up. And it's been doing this since you decided to put all your gold in Fort Knox and walk around with notes and coin that was not gold and silver. And that came over a period of time. That didn't just happen recently with Biden and Obama. That happened way back with FDR and LBJ and Wilson and Woodrow Wilson. This has been creeping in. And I have found in history, and I actually know some of the sons of some of the ministers who were warning people about this movement towards progressivism, although they weren't using the word progressive, just moving away from the ways of Christ and Moses. And most of your modern Jews today don't know that. They have a system of social welfare through men who exercise authority, and America has a system of social welfare through men who exercise authority, contrary to Moses and Jesus Christ. Their sacrifices are not free will sacrifices. They're not tithings. that like Abraham was doing with Melchizedek, their taxes. And you can go that way. That's the way of Cain. That was the way of at least one of the Lamechs in history. It's the way of Nimrod. And you can go that way. But the Bible is telling you what to expect if you go that way. And a lot of other people were telling you what to expect if you go that way. So we were on the way, and what was going to happen is, and you already saw it in North Africa, and there were, you know, like Hillary tried to stop it by attacking Gaddafi, because he was setting up a golden denarii to trade in oil. He was trying to take the purchase of oil off of the U.S. petrol dollar, which Kissinger had set up. And that was setting us up so that people wouldn't need dollars and they wouldn't be buying our treasury notes, and that would bring about the collapse. We won't go into the details of that, but there's a lot of evidence that explains all that. And so this idea that Trump is upset their plans to collapse the American economy, and who was doing that? The globalists. Because they were going to bring in this new world Babylonic order. Of course, they don't call it Babylonic order, but that's what there is going to be, the reset, where you're all going to be worldwide human resources instead of just human resources in the United States or in Panama or all these different countries or Canada. And Trump kind of stirred things up. Does he have the solution? And we could talk about that, but we'll do it somewhere else. But no, what he's doing is very dangerous. But the collapse was coming, whether he did it or not. It was definitely coming. And why is it coming? Because people forgot something that John Adams said. He said, our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. Well, is it moral? Is it part of the Christian religion or even the religion of Moses to covet your neighbor's goods through men who exercise authority? Well, it's not. And we lost sight of that. And we started doing that a little bit at first, a lot more. And now it's so common, we don't even think there's anything wrong with it. But that covetousness is idolatry. That is idolatry. And I'm not making it up. Colossians 3:5, mortify therefore your members which are upon the earth, fornication, uncleanness, inordinate affection, evil concupiscence, and covetousness, which is idolatry. For which thing's sake the wrath of God cometh on the children of disobedience. So if you're coveting your neighbor's goods through men who exercise authority, you're the children of disobedience. You're not a moral people. And the Constitution is not going to keep you free. There's other problems with the Constitution, but just the basics, the good things about it aren't going to be enough. Because you made a choice to covet your neighbor's goods. Or you made a choice to covet your own goods and not create, you know, public education through charity. You know, there's a schoolhouse down the road. Nobody uses it as a schoolhouse anymore. It's actually full of poisons. There's another schoolhouse that's brand new in the next valley. And it doesn't have any poison in it necessarily, but a lot of the ideas that are in it are poisonous to your children. It's not half bad if we compare it with everybody else, but if we pound that stake of morality that Christ gave us into the ground, we'd say, well, the whole idea of a public school through taxation is a bad idea because it's a covetous practice. It's idolatry. The same way with a fire department or a police department. You should have all those things through free will offerings. And if you don't, you'll break down the social bonds of a free society because you're not living according to the perfect law of liberty. You're living according to the ways of Terah and Nimrod and Bera, king of Sodom, and you're going to see a different result. But if you read Ephesians 5:5, for this ye know, that no whoremonger, nor unclean person, nor covetous man, who is an idolater. So he's again saying the covetous man is an idolater. If you're desiring benefits at the expense of your neighbor, you're an idolater. And you don't have any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and of God. That's what Ephesians 5 tells you. But nobody's making the connections in your mind. 1 Corinthians 5:10, yet not altogether with fornicators for this world. Fornicators with this world, are we talking sexual fornication or fornication with the harlot who rides the back of the beast? They don't give you your welfare. They tell you sign up with the government and they will give you your welfare. We're busy tickling your ears and telling you that you're saved. And, you know, we create rituals and ceremonies and have nice robes and, you know, processions and make you feel like you're following the ways of Moses and Jesus Christ. But your actual practices are not. It goes on in 1 Corinthians chapter 5:10, yet not altogether with those fornicators of this world. And that word world is constitutional order or system of government. That's what the Greek word means. There's five different words that could be world there. That one meant government. Fornication with the constitutional order and system of government, with the covetousness and extortioners, or with idolaters. For then must ye need go out of the world. The constitutional order and system of government. No, you can't just leave. You're in debt. You signed up. Your parents signed you up. Now, you could leave if you had some place to go, but I don't know where you could go today because it's every country's doing this. Every country in the world. What country are you going to go to? Well, the fact is that the kingdom of God is not a country. It's a way. You can go to the kingdom of God and start that way. Just like Israel did when they were in the bondage of Egypt. They didn't leave Egypt right away, but they started taking care of one another, actually through very hard times, and it began to alter them. But not completely enough, because obviously when they got out in the desert, Moses wasn't standing there. They went back to some of the idolatrous ways that would lead them back into Egypt. But he says, for which thing's sake the wrath of God cometh on the children of disobedience. That was in Colossians. But when, if we go back to Corinthians and verse 11, but now I have written unto you not to keep company. If any man that is called a brother be a fornicator or covetous or an idolater, now we know what those things are, or a railer, or, and it goes on to say, drunkard or extortioner with such and one, no, not to eat. Railer, what's a railer? That's the rebel. That's the guy who says, I will not comply. They don't want to comply with Christ and create the system of self-government through faith, hope, and charity. They just don't want to comply with the system that exercises authority. Now, they'll need to gather lots of people around them that think the same way because they're going to need help, but they're not get the bonds aren't the bonds of faith, hope, and charity, which was the bonds of the early Christians. Those Christians, those six men in Sillaton, 12 total, their heads were on the line. They could have said, oh, we'll sign up, and they would have been spared. But they didn't, and they were not spared. They lost their head. But so did the judge He lost his life. He lost his sight first and then died within a year, within less than a year of making this judgment. And you think that didn't have an effect on all the other judges throughout North Africa and even the empire? Saturninus had been stationed up at one time in what we would call Romania today. He was well known, although he's not well remembered except for this passage in the Bible, because every image of him has been destroyed for some reason. But understanding that what is the snare and the trap, David makes this very clear in Psalms, Proverbs makes it clear that it's the dainties of rulers that make you merchandise, that is the snare and the trap. Because rulers don't give you what they have, they give you what they take away from others. And so that's what brings you into bondage. And if you don't see that, then you're not going to see a lot. So, because when you covet, you're not the moral and religious people. Religion is how you take care of the needy. If you're not working on a way in which to take care of the needy through faith, hope, and charity, then you're not religious as Christ. You may be religious as the Pharisees, because Social Security is a religious program. It's public religion. It provides for the needy through forced offerings. And so that's very important to understand. Now, I mentioned Edmund Burke because, you know, before governments will change, men must change. And I always thought that Edmund Burke said that because it sounds like him. I can't find where he actually said that, so I don't attribute the quote to him. I've seen other people attribute the quote to him. But he did say, all who ever written on government are unanimous that among people generally corrupt, liberty cannot long exist. And of course, to covet your neighbor's goods, you know, to get free education, free health care, free welfare, all that is going to guarantee that you will not be free. Liberty, the greatest destroyers of liberty are the givers of gifts, gratuities, and benefits. Even pagans knew that. Plutarch said that. So it's very important that we understand these things, but also Burke was very critical of the French Revolution, and we won't have time to go into that. But when we come back, we're going to finish up a few of these other notes to do with what's going on today. And then we're going to understand what exactly can we learn from the Sillitan martyrs. We'll be right back. Well, welcome back to Keys of the Kingdom. So, yeah, these ideas have been around for a long time. And the problem is that we forget, or we don't remember, or we're not taught it. And, of course, taking over the public education and the books, and we wrote an article, Schools as Tools, showing you that there was actually a conspiracy to change the way in which Americans viewed history. And by doing that, they pulled the stakes out of the ground that we should be using as a measurement of, are we going the right way or are we going the wrong way? You know, during World War II, that was one of the things that the Germans did, was they moved signs around so that when the American troops came, they couldn't find their way around. They tried to look at the signs, but the signs had been altered. And so they had to figure out a different way of finding their way around places like France and Italy. And so we've done that in our own society, where some of the standards of Christ, and I just read you a bunch of them, concerning covetousness and idolatry, that most Christians, most Jews, most Muslims, all practice idolatry, if covetousness is idolatry. The Muslims are big for signing up for social welfare. Of course, they justify doing so because they already consider themselves better because they have the right book that they're following. But of course, Christians think they're following the Bible or they're following Christ, and Jews think they're following Moses and the prophets. But they're all engaging in these covetous practices because somebody pulled that stake up out of the ground, and we're not learning from that. Yet, I can give you quote after quote from even pagans that say that if you engage in these covetous practices, you know, the masses develop an appetite for benefits and the habit of receiving them at the expense of others, they will degenerate as a people into perfect savages, finding once more a monarch and a king. That's an idea that's been around for a long time. I can guarantee almost unquestionably that at the local public school, both to my north and to the south, they do not teach that in their studies of history. I will venture to guess that their teachers they're not even aware of that. Yet nature itself, the human mind itself, should tell you that if you don't use your power of choice, it will atrophy. And using your power of choice, you have to choose rightly. You know, when people say, do you believe in the Bible? I always hear people asking people that question. Of course I believe in the Bible. I don't know about a course you believe in the Bible. Do you believe in the Logos of Christ? The Word of Christ. The Bible records the Word. It's in there. The Word meaning Logos, which is the right reason of Christ. It records it. But just as I've read you several quotes today, they ignore it. They don't follow it. Because the modern Social Security or National Insurance, whatever country you're in, those are all identical to the Corban of the Pharisees. They're all public religion. They're all funded by funds that are provided by either taking away from your neighbor or borrowing against the future of your children, which will curse children with that debt. And they don't want to see it. You know, I just said it several different ways. How many want to see it? How many want to gather together to provide true religion, unspotted by the world? And the word world, again, when they talk about religion unspotted, is the word for constitutional order or system of government. Why can't you take care of the needy through government? Because the governments of the world use force. Now, Jesus preached to government, but he said you can't use force. You're supposed to take care of the needy, you know, provide for widows and orphans and the needy of your society through the government of God, but you can't use force. You have to use charity. This is what Jacob had to accept before he could be called Israel. And that's what everybody has to accept before they can call themselves Christian. Because and if they won't, they have need of repentance. They may not be born again if they don't love the light of that truth. Because you can say you're born again, but the evidence of that being born again is not your personal testimony, but your actual persona testimony. Do you love the light? Do you love the truth? And the truth is, we're supposed to be taking care of one another through faith, hope, and charity and the perfect law of liberty, and not through men who exercise authority. And of course, the Christians being tried, the Silitan martyrs, they know they can't sign up for the public religion of Saturninus. They can't sign up for that. And so in our page on the Acts of the Sultan Martyrs, we put this to several AIs and asked these questions. And AI now comes up with the actual answer. They don't come up with it at first, and we've gone through that, and we have the recordings of going over it. But we finally got through the three parts of, you know, this idea of what the AI said is a profound assessment, which is what, you know, we've written books on this assessment. I've written hundreds of articles on it. That there's a Roman system of state welfare through taxation, and there's a Christian system through pure religion, which is voluntary charity, fervent charity, taking care of the needy. There was the bread of Rome, and there was the daily ministration that rightly divided the bread from house to house with Christians. The Sultan martyrs used the Christian method, and Saturninus was charging them with evading taxes that is supposed to go to supporting the bread of Rome. And they feared more and more people signing up for the bread of Christ, the Eucharist of Christ, and not signing up for the free bread of Rome, because that funded their welfare system, which made them popular with a lot of people. The all the people that are coming in and getting on welfare, you know, we saw that in the Somali community. They would vote straight across the board Democrat. And they did it because the Democrats brought them in, gave them power, and they were making lots of money. And they wanted to sign up for that system. But so there was those two parts. And then AI put down this third part, which he said, the bread of Rome versus the bread of Christ. And he actually created a table that shows, you know, one has operates by allegiance, the snare and the trap, and the other one operated by covenantal thanksgiving, the Eucharist, free will offerings. And this is the same division that we see with Abraham and Terah and Jacob and Laban. Jacob became Israel because he set up altars to take care of the needy of society. He gave liberty back to the people that worked for him. Even Abraham, he could have owned all those people and kept all the stuff. He wouldn't keep any of this stuff, but he also wouldn't own the people. They were free to choose which way they were going, just like you're free to choose which way you're going. But you can't erase the bondage that you created. So the idea that you become a Christian, now you don't owe taxes anymore, is nonsense. It wasn't the way Moses operated in Egypt. It wasn't the way that Christ operated in Judea. If you owe the tax, pay the tax. But eventually, the Pharisees, at least the Pharisees, were told and told others that if you get the baptism of Jesus Christ, which is signing up for his system of social welfare, which John the Baptist already told you that it operates on charity, you know, if you have extra, you share with those that don't have enough. That's the kingdom of God. The kingdom of Herod, if you have extra, we will tell you what is extra, and we will take the extra away, and we will decide who gets it. That's the two different systems. One is a system that exercises authority one over the other. The other one is a system that exercises love. So now that you know that basic, you can tell the difference between who is a Christian and who is a false Christian, who is a fake Christian. And unfortunately for a lot of people, they're going to say, well, my goodness, well, I do it the way, you know, where I depend upon men who exercise authority. That's how I take care of the needy. I saw a video of a famous Democrat, a black, I can't remember what his name is. I should have looked it up. I'm just terrible at names. But he was actually interviewing his daughter. And she was very nice, young. She evidently had children already. So she was married. I assume you can have children without being married. But he was asking her if she would take care of him when he was old and couldn't take care of himself. And she says, in my house, with my children, with my pool, and with my car? She says, no. She says, old folks home. I don't know. She used the word old folks home, convalescent home. You know, she was going to put them in a home. She wasn't going to take them into her home. And she was adamant about this, repeated it over and over again. You could see the disappointment in his eyes. He's a Democrat, but he's actually, I've seen him have more conversations with conservative politicians. Not that that's with Christians. They may think they're Christians, but he's more open to those conversations. But he was taken back. His daughter was adamant she wasn't going to take care of him. And, of course, that was the complaint of the Corbin of the Pharisees, is that they did no more ought for their parents. That, because I give to the state religion, to Herod's civil system of religion, I've signed up, I have to pay in. And now, if you need anything, my parents need anything, they're supposed to go to the temple, which was a bank. It had all these funds pouring in on a regular basis. Herod liked it. Jesus disapproved. But it's what everybody is doing today. They're either dependent upon the money that's coming in, and I use the word money loosely because they've already abandoned just weights and measures, which is also a requirement if you're going to be seeking the kingdom. But we will have to overcome that. And first, we have to get the love down and the charity down. And of course, what Christ commanded, that his ministers make the people sit down in the tens, hundreds, and thousands, because you can't do this unless you network together. It's just not going to work. It will be total chaos. And the early church organized in that fashion, so that when there was a dearth, Paul knew who to go and bring funds to and bring food to and supplies to. And Christians were doing well. But now these Christians are being tried. They've already explained, this is 180, 30 years before. We already saw Justin, who is known as Justin the Martyr, writing to Antoninus Pius, the emperor of Rome, saying, this is how we do it. We gather once a week, and those that have share with those that don't have enough. That's how the kingdom of God works. If that's not what you're doing, if you're just gathering once a week to tickle each other's ears and slap each other on the back and say, oh, I love you, brother, I love you, brother. But if you need anything, you better go to the men who exercise authority, because I have no system. We're not, at the church, we're not rightly dividing the bread from house to house. That's the job of the government, which of course is idolatry. You see the dilemma that we're getting? So I put another question to Gemini. I use Gemini. I have a link there on the page to my original conversation with Grok. And it's interesting because they organize it. And then, of course, I go along and I connect it to the articles we've already written, because we already knew what the answer was. As a matter of fact, the first answers that usually came from AI were wrong. And we called them out on it. And that's what is in this second question. My second comment to Gemini, tax avoiding versus evading. And I say, you, Gemini, that's who I'm talking to, state, quote, saw a dangerous tax evading counterculture in Christianity. But the truth is they were engaged in tax avoidance because Christ was innocent and proclaimed King of the Jews by Pilate, and Jesus appointed a kingdom in Luke 22:29. Paul would win his case with Agrippa and Festus and did not need to appeal to Rome in Acts 26. But private religion had been legal, but in this case, in the Cilician, is where Vigilius Saturninus, proconsul of Africa, outlawed private religion. That's, historians will refer to this as outlawing private religion, because Christianity was private religion. It was private because it was separate. You had lots of different religious groups in Rome, but they were all licensed through the government of Rome. Christianity was licensed through the government of Christ. And there was a government of Christ, Pontius Pilate, and we've explained this in articles. Pilate was the procurator of Rome. And that plaque where he writes in three languages on ebony wood that is covered with white plaster, he writes that Jesus Christ is King of the Jews. This is the King of the Jews. So, and his kingdom was not a part of the world of Rome. And we explain that in great detail. Because there was no legitimate contract with, there were factions. You know, the Pharisees were taking the free bread of Rome. The shiploads of grain were delivered to the Pharisees, and they had laws on the book, and we explain this in the book, Covenants of the Gods. We don't have time to go through all that right now, but I might put in some more footnotes so you can see it. But so I'm putting it to them, and I even point out that Tertullian's treatise talks about Vigilius seems to have died in Carthage shortly after losing his eyesight, within the year 181. And of course, this trial is in 180, in the middle of 180. So what was Gemini's response? Gemini says, your analysis presents a compelling legal defense of early Christian practices by framing it through the lens of Roman judicial boundaries, biblical mandates, and historical divine retribution, which is that leader went blind. Remember, there was a guy who said that he was also the King of the Jews, King of Judea, and his belly ruptures open, and he falls down and dies, and there's worms coming out of his belly, and he says, I've sinned against God and man. And so the competition for the position, Christ was King of Judea. Your modern historians kind of skip over that. But at that time, according to the biblical text, yeah, he was. And he appointed his government. But his government was not to exercise authority, but was to rightly divide the bread from house to house, to provide a social welfare safety net through charity alone. And that's what the church should be doing. But it can't do it unless the people come together. And we lay out how they can do that. But you got to do it. Or you can keep going along like you've been going. And see how that works out for you. So this idea of this analysis that Christianity, early Christianity, was practicing pure religion. This perspective, Gemini goes on to say, this perspective highlights a crucial point from the Christian worldview. Their assembly and community funding were completely legal under higher constitutional order that stood entirely apart from Rome's civil administration. Now, that may not mean much to you, but this is why we wrote the Free Church Report, which is free online. And we have some studies up on that already, where we go through that. But if you join the network, People will help guide you to, there's so much information there. And there's going to be, we're going to create more questions than answers by our answers, except for we've already done our homework and we have the answers so that you can study it. But ultimately, I don't believe you'll see this unless you start to do what John the Baptist called us to do, what Christ called us to do, repent, think differently. And we're showing you how to think differently. So when analyzing, AI goes on to say, when analyzing this historical and theological intersection, which is a very interesting choice of words, intersection, several distinct legal and linguistic elements emerge. Tax avoidance versus tax evasion is his first thing. The legal jurisdiction. Your distinction between tax avoidance and evasion hits on the fundamental jurisdictional argument. Imperial perspective. So he breaks this down into imperial perspective. The Roman governor, the refusal to pay into the imperial cult of Rome. I should put a link there because we have an article explaining what the imperial cult of Rome was and why was it called a cult. Because once you signed up, you couldn't just unsign. It was a binding agreement. You might be able to unsign, but you better move to Parthia or someplace. Because as long as you're within the Roman jurisdiction, I don't know where you're going to go. And the problem was the same drama was being carried out in Parthia. Most people have no idea of the history of the time. But the imperial cult or participate in the state-mandated temple funds appeared as an unlawful withholding of civic obligations. Essentially a form of civic subversion. So from one point of view, that's the way they're seeing it. Christian legal defense, as you noted, referring to what I had already told them, Christians argued that their system was legitimate, non-coercive, separate, holy, that would be holy, sphere. By obeying Christ's command to render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's, they paid their regular civil taxes, tributum. However, they argued that the state had no legal right to compel their religious charitable capital, which was reserved for Christ's independent kingdom. Because they paid their civil taxes, but legally opted out of the pagan religious funds. They viewed their actions as lawful avoidance of an unconstitutional overreach by the state. So this is his first tax avoidance versus tax evasion. AI is, of course, agreeing with what I was saying, but it actually backs it up with some information. Of course, we back it up. So the second part of this is entitled Cosmos of a Constitutional Order. Cosmos is the word that is often translated world. It means, as I quote right out of the Concordance, constitutional order or system of government. We have whole articles on that. I'll put some more links into our Sillotin article on that. Your linguistic parsing of cosmos provides an accurate framework for understanding Christ's statement to Pilate in John 18:36. My kingdom is not of this world. And we have extensive articles on that. Pilate was about to sit in judgment of Jesus Christ, and Jesus says, my kingdom's not of this world. You ain't got no jurisdiction. That's what Pilate was being told by Jesus. And then he goes and washes his hands of the case because he agrees with Jesus. Finds no guilt in the man. He doesn't have any obligation because he's not signed up with Caesar. The Pharisees had. They were going to end up rebelling and bringing about the destruction of Jerusalem. We'll be back to finish this drama. Well, welcome back to Keys of the Kingdom. So we were in the midst of looking at this second part of the answer to this dilemma of tax avoidance or tax evasion. Christ does not promote tax evasion very clearly, and neither did Moses. They had to pay their tally of bricks and glean in the field at night for their straw, which is part of their benefit package, and their leeks and onions, etc. And in this second part of a four-part response to this by Gemini, he says, under cosmos as a constitutional order, AI says your linguistic parsing of cosmos provides an accurate framework for understanding Christ's statement to Pilate, which is his kingdom was not of the world. It says, while cosmos can mean the physical earth, it really can't. This is, translators are traitors. There are very clear Greek words if you want to talk about the earth. There's ekomene, which is inhabited places, and there's gay, which is the actually terra firma. The other place we see the word world is aeon, which means age. It's a period of time. You know, it's if you know at the end of the world, when you see that phrase, it's almost always end of the aeon, which is end of an age. And at the end of an age, there's another age that begins. So the reality is, I didn't question it on it, but I just wanted to put that in there. It talks about in classical, political, and philosophical Greek, it explicitly refers to a regular order, arrangement, or system of government. And, you know, I have an article on cosmos. I have an article on world. And in the article on world, I quote right out of the concordance, it is defined as an apt, harmonious arrangement or constitution, order, or government. It comes from, and you know, I go back to the original uses of the word that they, in the Homeric, cosmio is used in reference to the act of marshaling troops. That's how much it's about ordering. It's about that collection of human resources and organizing and inventory, and everybody has their position. And that's what cosmos has to do with. I can tell you 700 BC, the definition of the word carved in stone and what it means. It actually comes from the word komizo, which in the Greek means to care for, take care of, and provide for. If you're those martial troops, somebody's going to bring you bread and cheese and wine to help, you know, the army traveling on its belly. And of course, in the case of Abraham, that was brought by Melchizedek, the righteous king of peace. And how did Melchizedek have the funds to do that? Free will offerings. Same as Paul going out to all the different churches during famines, dearths in the land. He's bringing them supplies. And he's also collecting funds from those that are well off, or at least well off to share, and bringing them back to other places like Jerusalem to be redistributed as wave offerings. We've explained what a wave offering is. And even to Ephesus, because often it gets hard in one place, but it's still okay in another. And Christianity had set up this system through Christ, beginning with John the Baptist and the early church, so that they were able to gather once a week, and those that had shared with those that didn't have enough, but they were also a network that extended beyond the Roman Empire into Britain, into Parthia, and to other places where if things got too bad, like when Mount Vesuvius blew up in Pompeii and Christians had to flee, they had a place to go to. And even more important, they got a heads up. Evidently, like we've talked about him before, the Christian baker had time to pack up his stuff and get out of town. So by the time the ashes got to his bakery, he and his family had already left. Because when we look through the bakery, we see, well, this guy had some time to pack up stuff. Other places, the people were just in ashes, you know, covered in ashes. They died in the flames. But it appears at least one Christian had a heads up and knew to leave. Just like we saw with Lot. Now, Lot was told over and over again, you got to get out of here, Lot. Lot, you're running out of time. And finally, because he was the nephew of Abraham, evidently, to some degree, I don't know the reasoning of God all the time, but it appears that they had to physically grab Lot and take him out. It took his whole family out, his daughter and everything, but his wife went back. And of course, we'll have that in the future. But in your future, do you think you will know when you need to move from where you're at to where you need to be? Or are you going to figure this out through the tree of knowledge? Well, no, this is the thing, is that when God starts taking the scales off your eyes to see his actual system, he's going to also show you what you need personally to do. You're not going to have to go to your priest and say, okay, priest, should I leave town? Should I move out of LA? Should I move to Tennessee or one of these tax havens in Brazil? No. You're going to be following what God's putting on your heart. It's going to be a still small voice. It's not going to be one based on fear. But anyway, so when we're looking at this summary by AI, I had to beg difference with his interpretation of what the word cosmos means. But he does say, consequently, the tithes and Eucharist of the church belong to an entirely separate, non-competing jurisdictional order. Now, there's a lot of things that you could do to affect that order, where you wouldn't entirely be separate. And so that's another whole, AI didn't go into that, but at least they acknowledge that the Eucharist of Christ was completely separate. And of course, this is why I say Jesus was one of the greatest legal minds in history. And I shouldn't say one of, he is the greatest legal mind in history. And this whole thing starts all fitting into place. But the question is, are you on the side of Christ or are you on the side of Herod? Are you eating at the table of Herod and the Pharisees and their public religion and the table of Saturninus and Caesar's public religion? Or are you setting the table of the Lord? Are you eating at the table of rulers? Proverbs tells us that if you sit and eat with a ruler and you be a man of appetite, put a knife to your throat, for he serves you deceitful meats. It's part of the same message over and over again. We have a whole article on that. Look up the word knife at preparing you, or look up the word dainties, because it also tells you about eating the dainties of rulers is a snare and a trap. David tells you that in Psalms. And Paul quotes David in the New Testament, which I have said over and over again. But let's look at number three in this. I think there were four parts to it, yeah. Number three is the decree on the cross and the legal precedent. The inscription placed by Pontius Pilate on the cross, Jesus Nazarenus Rex Ideorum. Now, of course, it was in three languages. That's one of them. Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews, served as an official public Roman legal decree. They say that. AI says that. I've been saying it for years. I didn't tell him I said that. But anyway, Under Roman law, the governor's decree held binding legal weight because Pilate officially proclaimed Jesus a king while simultaneously finding no fault in him. A powerful legal precedent was established. Christ's kingdom was recognized by a Roman magistrate as non-subversive to Caesar. And now Vigilius Saturninus is overruling Pontius Pilate. Well, there's more to the story than he brings up, but at least he brought that much up. In a second part of this section 3, he goes on to say, therefore, when the proconsul like Vigilius Saturninus later outlawed Christian assemblies and private charities, they were effectively reversing the judicial logic established by Pilate and ignoring the lawful status that private religious groups, collegia, that would be a private religious group, had traditionally enjoyed under Roman law, provided they do not engage in active treason. You know, to some degree, there's a lot of Muslims trying to create this same status that Christ created. They don't understand it, but they're trying to create that separateness. And they have Sharia law and all this stuff. But they constantly are entertaining treason. No, I'm against treason. This is why you don't say bad things about the government. This is why you don't say, I mean, you legitimate criticism, but this should always be in a constructive vein, realizing what powers they have and where they come from and what powers they don't have. And of course, eventually there may come a conflict, but who's going to resolve that conflict? Rebellious rioters? No. God's power, like we see on the shores of the Red Sea, where God intervened and said, no, you're not touching mine. These are mine. You can't do that. There was a Pharaoh there at that scene. It wasn't the Pharaoh. We'll get off topic. There's a variety of pharaohs. There was, because a pharaoh, they had a military pharaoh and they had a civil pharaoh. And then, of course, the pharaoh who was the head over all of them. And they're all related. But the pharaoh wasn't down there at the shores of the Red Sea. But the military pharaoh was. And there were also military soldiers following the guys who didn't follow Moses and went the normal way. But this is all part of the history. We're going to try to stay focused on these basics. There is a part in here that AI doesn't present, which we do present if you study our articles on Pontius Pilate, that he was the procurator of Rome at that time. But let's look at number 4 and get through that. And number 4, it mentions the fate of Vigilius Saturninus, according to the Tertullian record. Your historical reference to the fate of the proconsul is remarkably accurate according to early Christian historical texts. In his polemical treatise addressed to the Roman governor Scapula, the early Christian writer Tertullian, we have an article on Tertullian, specifically chronicles the divine retribution that befell the very first prosecutors of the African church. And he says prosecutors of the African church. Well, this is the Christian church in Africa is what they're talking about. And in the Ad Scapulum, Chapter 3, Tertullian explicitly names Vigilius Saturninus and records his sudden blindness and subsequent death. And I have a quote in there, who was the first here to use the sword against us, lost his eyesight. Historian confirms that Saturninus' proconsular term in Africa concluded in 181 for early Christian communities. His sudden physical blindness, rapid death following the execution of the Cilician martyrs, were seen as an immediate, undeniable act of divine judgment, a supernatural vindication, providing that the proconsul had acted unjustly and unlawfully against the citizens of Christ's kingdom. And I put two quotes underneath this. These are, now that's the end of that particular AI, although there is another section that I don't think we'll have time to get into, but I put in the quotes, John 9:39, and Jesus said, "For judgment I am come into this world, and they which see not might see, and they which see might be made blind." And of course, that's a statement that could suggest that the blindness of Saturninus was the result of the fact that he set himself against the true followers of Christ. This only works for true followers of Christ. John 3:3, Jesus answered and said unto him, "Verily, verily, I say unto thee, except a man be born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God." So that's another thing I like to point out regularly, is that you cannot even understand what I'm talking about, this kingdom of God, and in the proper light of Jesus Christ, without the light of Jesus Christ, which goes all the way back to the original vision when I first talked about Abraham, where there was this fiery furnace and burning lamp. That you have to be willing to lay down your life. You have to be willing to give up what you thought was true and admit, well, I guess that's not true, in order for God to restore your sight. And even being born again, if we read the concepts of this idea of being born again to eternal life, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. For God sent not his Son into the world to condemn the world, which is that constitutional order and system of government, so you shouldn't be doing it either, but that the world through him might be saved. Might be saved. And of course, we're dealing with the individuals who are trapped in the world, trapped in the constitutional orders and systems, are snared in those systems. He that believeth on him is not condemned, but he that believeth not is condemned already, because he hath not believed in the name of the only begotten Son of God. And the name is not Jesus. The name is the character of Jesus, the way of Jesus, the righteousness of Jesus, the logos of Jesus, the right reason of Jesus. In verse 19, he goes on to say, "And this is the condemnation, that light is come into the world, and men love the darkness rather than the light, because their deeds were evil." And the word evil there is phaneros. And if you go to our article on John 3, you know, we have, there's lots of footnotes in there, so you can do a word search on your own. But for everyone that doeth evil, which is not phaneros, but phallus, hateth the light, neither cometh to the light, lest his deeds should be reproved. But he that doeth truth, aletheia is the Greek word there for truth, aletheia, cometh to the light, that his deeds may be made manifest, that they are wrought in God. Now, are you saved by your deeds? No. But if you're only a sayer of the word and not a doer of the word, then the light may not come to you. The fact is that in being a doer of the work, might get your head cut off in North Africa. But they chose to let, you know, they didn't invite him to cut their head. Well, actually, they sort of did, if you, because we have the references of the trial, at least pretty accurately in the original languages that we see there, the Latin languages that we see there, that they're saying, okay, don't wait. We're not going to change your mind. We're not signing up for your system of social welfare through the state, through men who exercise authority one over the other. We're not going to do that because Jesus said it's not to be that way with us, and we're going to stick to Jesus's plan. But the modern Christian, they're all willing to sign up. As a matter of fact, even suggest they maybe shouldn't be signing up for all these benefits. Oh, they get all worked up. They get very upset. And they really shouldn't, because this is the way. But many people hateth the light. They don't want to see it. How do you see it? Burning furnace. How come the furnace is burning? It's because somebody sacrificed. Somebody laid down part of their life to go into the furnace to burn up. Remember, burn up, a burnt offering is something given up entirely. And with that burning furnace, that daily sacrifice, will come the light. Not for everybody, but for all those who are willing to go the way of Christ and turn their words into deeds. You're not saved again by your deeds, you're saved by grace. But if there is no deeds, your faith is dead. And if you're eating at the table of rulers, you're not living by faith, you're living by allegiance. Allegiance is a form of faith. It's compelled faith. God does not compel your faith. He requires it, that you live by faith. But a lot of times he can count things as righteous that in themselves are not really righteous. And we see that over, you know, Noah was righteous in his generations, and God counted it as a righteousness, enough so that he used Noah and Noah's descendants, which includes Shem, who was Melchizedek, who after his father had died, he still hadn't blessed somebody else to be the heir of Shem. You know, because there were a lot of Shemites, you know, Semites, as we call them today, descendants of Shem, thousands of them, all over. But the ones that he blessed was Abraham. And anybody who goes the way of Abraham will receive that blessing. They are the true Semites. Now, bloodline, there's a lot of people that are descendants of Shem. A lot of people. But you have to walk in faith to be the seed of Abraham. I tell you that over and over again in the New Testament. If you're not walking in faith, if you're not living by faith, hope, and charity, you're not the seed of Abraham. You can tell me you're Jewish. You can tell me you're a Pharisee. You can tell me. But if you're not doing what Abraham said to do, and the amazing thing is, if you do what Abraham was doing and what Abraham said to do and what Jacob, who became Israel, was doing and what Moses said to do, if you're doing that, you'll be doing what Christ said to do, because they were all saying the same thing. And Pontius Pilate wanted to know what the truth was. And as that procurator of Rome, Pontius Pilate said, hey, I find no fault in this man. And he made that official plaque. If he was the procurator of Rome, we pointed this out before, is that he was married to the favorite granddaughter of Tiberius. And Tiberius had already retired because of his health to an island. And special laws were passed so that Pontius Pilate's wife could go with him to Judea. So she was there in Judea by special laws that were passed. So people complain about laws like 219 and sections and all this stuff. We'll have to talk about that later. I do come on our app call on Thursday, but you have to join us on the network to get on that call. Until then, peace on your house and may God be with you. God bless.
You have been listening to The Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church. For more information on the educational ministry provided by His Holy Church and Brother Gregory, including services, counseling, lectures, books, and other audio materials, please write to His Church at Summer Lake, Box 10, Summer Lake, Oregon, 97640. You can also find us on the web at www.hisholychurch.net.